Joining me on the line is Ray McGovern, former U.S. Army captain and CIA intelligence analyst for 27 years. Ray was born and raised in the Bronx and graduated summa cum laude at Fordham University. And you were a distinguished military graduate serving in the U.S. Army from 62 to 64 as an intelligence officer. You also received an M.A. in Russian studies from Fordham, a certificate in theological studies from Georgetown University, and you were a graduate of Harvard Business School's Advanced Management Program. Ray, thanks for joining us today.
You're most welcome.
You were in the news recently for attending a speech that Hillary Clinton had given, and you were minding your own business. Actually, you had your back turned to her. I saw the video, and you weren't saying a thing, but I guess they had asked you to take your seat, and you refused, and you were manhandled out of there. And of course, that's all over the internet. But for the benefit of our listeners, you served in the Army. You were in government in the Central Intelligence Agency under seven presidents over the 27 years, and you presented the morning intelligence briefings at the White House for many of them.
Nixon, Ford, and Reagan. I did brief the first Bush regularly, but it was while he was vice president.
And so you were in intelligence gathering, is that right, Ray?
Intelligence analysis, really. We guided the collection, but our job was to be at the end of the process. We would be in receipt of the intelligence that was gathered, collected, or downloaded, or whatever you want to say. And it was our job to process that, put it all together, and if the story was important enough, the President of the United States would likely be reading about it the next morning, mostly because my account was the Soviet Union. And as you can remember, back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, Soviet Union was at the top of everybody's list for interest in intelligence analysis.
At this point, however, you would be, I guess, categorized as a political activist or a peace activist. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, I like Alice Walker's definition of activist. It's the price one pays for living in a democracy. It's really quite amazing to me that the word activist has some sort of pejorative connotation here. Yeah, I'm an activist. I have been, and while I was with the CIA, I was an activist. Our job was to tell the truth, and for the most part, we did precisely that. And now I'm an activist because the CIA and many other governmental institutions have been corrupted almost beyond repair, and I'm trying to act now to warn people about that so that there can be some repair and we can get back on an even keel.
Mm-hmm. Was there one event that kind of pushed you into the activist camp?
Well, you know, people ask me that a lot. You know, when did you fall off your horse, or when did you see the light?
Right.
When did you decide to go straight? This betrays a lack of understanding of the fact, the reality, that there are really two CIAs. One, the one that President Truman set up to give him unfettered analysis without policy preference or influence from the State Department or the Pentagon, and a place where all the information on a given issue or country would be available to analysts. So there would be no more Pearl Harbors. Now, that's the analysis part of the CIA. It was set up, but by an accident of history, the covert operators that came back from World War II were asking around, say, well, do you still need us? And the question answered itself when you looked at Eastern Europe, you looked around the world with the KGB. And the only problem was that they decided to put the operations people together with the institution that President Truman founded, and you have a structural fault there that cannot be overcome. You cannot be running wars in Nicaragua and elsewhere and also give the president at the same time an unadulterated, unbiased view on what the prospects for succeeding in that war are. It's clear as the nose on anyone's face. So it's a long answer, but the short answer to your question was there was one event that stirred me back into action after I retired, and that was in 2002 as I watched our administration deliberately, well, the word really is prostitute. The word really is corrupt. My profession, okay? My profession was intelligence analysis. The only reason for having us in business was to tell the truth. And my profession and the people who followed me, my former colleagues, were corrupted. The express purpose of deceiving our elected representatives out of their constitutional prerogative to declare or otherwise authorize war. It doesn't get any worse than that. And a small band of us got together. We formed Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. We compiled three reports for the president before the attack on Iraq. And we've got about 20 to our credit now. Problem is, not only does the president not listen, but what I call the fawning corporate media, others call it the mainstream media, they won't give us the time of day. We get all kinds of exposure abroad, nothing in the mainstream media. So when you began to say, with respect to my incident with Hillary Clinton, that I've been very much in the news, well, it will not be surprising to me that the vast majority of your listeners may not know what happened because it was not in the news. It was in the alternative news. It was on the internet, but no one carried it except Fox News. And they carried it under a very misleading heading, which said, a heckler interrupted Clinton's speech today. It added in the text that this elderly man, this is a quote, was perhaps trying to hold up a sign, or maybe he was going to shout out. So he was, quote, escorted, end quote, away and said, so this is America. Well, that's wrong on all counts. I was not heckling. I didn't say a word. I was standing there with my back to the secretary, not making a motion or a word, silently, when I was set upon by two, well, they looked like two NFL rejects, lifted bodily above the four women that were sitting between me and the aisle, dragged out of the place before I could figure out what was happening to me. The only thing I had time to say was, so this is America. And then you can hear me asking as I'm going out, because the fellow doing the arm lock and the real damage was a plainclothes goon. You can hear me asking, who are you? Who are you? And you know what? I never got an answer to that question.
I did watch the video and I did hear that. Just for our listeners, I want to let them know that this can be viewed on YouTube, of course, and the title of the video is Hillary Clinton Interrupted by Protester 15.02.2011. It's a short video. It's only 53 seconds. Of course, this happens at the end when a camera pans over to you being manhandled.
Yeah, if people are interested in more than that little clip that doesn't show much, Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! Had me on 2 days later. That would have been the 17th of February. And there's a good 5 minutes of what happened there, including Amy's questions and my answers. All that from democracynow.org.
You were born in 1939. That makes you either 71 or 72. Of course, we said previously you're 71, right?
Correct.
And you served in the Army from 62 to 64. What were your years with the CIA?
That was 64 until 1990, 6 weeks before 9/11. Condoleezza Rice said, and I quote, Saddam Hussein has no weapons of mass destruction. He's not even a threat to his immediate neighbors, end quote. That was July 31st, 2001. Now, with 9/11, of course, in other words, the 11th of September, just 6 weeks later, everything changed. And so that must have meant that whereas Saddam Hussein had no weapons of mass destruction before 9/11, after 9/11, we're hearing almost immediately from Dick Cheney, from Don Rumsfeld, from Condoleezza Rice, that Saddam Hussein has all manner of weapons of mass destruction. He's a threat not only to his immediate neighbors, but to us, and we have to zap him before he can use these weapons of mass destruction or give them to terrorists to use on us. I mean, you didn't have to be a crackerjack analyst to figure out what was going on, Dave. This is as deceitful a thing as you can imagine. And I suppose one of the major lessons is that not one person in the mainstream media took the trouble to go back and see what Condoleezza Rice had said just 6 months before, and Colin Powell said it a few months before that, what they said about WMD, so to speak, before 9/11, and then all of a sudden, it strained credulity. One had to imagine that weapons of mass destruction descended, wafted down like manna from heaven onto the sand of Iraq, under which God made that terrible mistake of putting our oil.
9/11, if we could just talk about that briefly. That obviously was and still is a significant event for pretty much everybody in the world. And there are a lot of different views that have been proposed about 9/11, especially when it comes to fire collapsing all three steel structures. And of course, Building 7 having a very small fire in it, and then it just collapsed into its own footprint. That doesn't make sense. And really, for anyone with not even half a brain, it doesn't make sense. And as a former intelligence analyst, and obviously you still practice analytical skills, seeing that Building 7 collapse the way it did from really nothing, just right into its own footprint, hearing Larry Silverstein the leaseholder of the World Trade Center. That probably just happened around the same time that Condoleezza Rice said that Hussein had no weapons of mass destruction. I think it actually did happen around the same week. Knowing that and seeing that and knowing that in the history of steel frame buildings, none have ever been brought down by fires. And hearing Silverstein in a documentary say that, well, that's why we decided to pull Building 7. What do you think? You think that 19 Muslim hijackers with box cutters hiding in a cave did 9/11? Or do you think that elements of our own government, coupled with foreign elements, such as that of Israel, whose fingerprints are all over 9/11, do you think they had something to do with it?
Well, Dave, your questions are good ones. And that's the problem. There are all kinds of very good questions out there. And there are people who know the answers or know some of the answers. The problem is that those people who know the answers will not tell us. And that is a kind of situation that makes it unconscionable for those same people to be calling others who are trying to find the answers out to calling them conspiracy theorists. So when the head of the 9/11 Commission, the 9/11 Commission was a sham. It was a cover-up. When the head of the 9/11 Commission, distinguished Governor Kaine from New Jersey, and Lee Hamilton, the person that the Democrats always trot out when they want to do an investigation like this, when they say, as they did in their book, that their investigation was doomed to fail because they were not given enough time, they were not given enough money, they were not given enough good people, they were not given enough access to the sensitive information. And when they say that it was doomed to fail, and it did fail, well, hello, does anybody think that maybe a really independent investigation should take place to explore these questions? Well, I sure as heck do, and I know that there was an initiative in New York City to do precisely that, and there was some sort of political machinations that prevented that from happening. I do hope that my New Yorker friends will be able to force through the kind of investigation that will shed light on these questions. Otherwise, it's just a big, big blur with lots of attempts to explain it all, but nothing that I've seen that explains the whole thing. We need an independent investigation, and we don't need politicians. Now, one thing I'll say about the 9/11 Commission, every one of those people were politicians. Almost every one of those were lawyers. Now, you know, if somebody's going to argue that these people were representative of the people who were killed on 9/11, you know, I'd say that doesn't make any sense. These people all had access to grind. Some were actually in office when all this happened. It's unconscionable that they were allowed to do this. They were, as my Irish grandmother would say, they were the upper crust. And the way she defined the upper crust was a bunch of crumbs held together by a lot of dough.
That's a good one. I guess many people have great difficulty wrapping their minds around the possibility that our own country could murder 3,000 of its citizens. Is that something that prevents you from analyzing this beyond that point?
Nothing has prevented me from looking at the evidence. I'm an intelligence analyst, okay, and I'm not the one that would share the approach that the Bush administration suggested, namely faith-based intelligence. I look at the empirical record. I try to figure out what it means. And quite aside from any predisposition to believe our government or not to believe them, I'm at sea on this one. I can't figure out exactly what happened, and so I reserve judgment. I'm not going to jump into something that I can't justify based on the empirical record.
Mm-hmm. On the Wikipedia website, they have a segment in here called OIL, oil, and it says in a television interview on MSNBC, you said, "I've been using the acronym OIL for many years. O for oil, I for Israel, and L for logistics." Logistics being the permanent, now we say enduring, military bases that the U.S. wants to keep in Iraq. And of course, the Washington Post, it says, reported that in your testimony, you declared that the United States went to war in Iraq for oil, Israel, and military bases craved by administration neocons so the United States and Israel could dominate that part of the world. Do you still believe that?
Of course. It's as clear as the nose on your face. Does the United States and Israel dominate that part of the world? Of course they do. Do they want to keep doing it? Of course they do. Was Israel part of the calculation? Well, we have empirical evidence now. Before, it was largely analysis. We have Tony Blair, the former British Prime Minister, admitting before the Chilcot Commission earlier this year that while he and Bush were planning about Iraq in April in Crawford, Texas, they were in constant communication with the Israelis. As Blair put it, Israel was on the top of the agenda then, and we were in periodic consultation with Israeli leaders. So this was a big part of our meeting there at Crawford in April of 2002, okay? Now, what are you doing talking to the Israelis in April 2002 as they're planning a mission to attack Iraq and commit what Nuremberg called the war of aggression, the supreme international crime? So that's just one little thing that came out over the last months, but there's abundant evidence that the Israelis were cheering for this war, and the newspapers that the Israelis influenced, the New York Times first and foremost, the Washington Post, they were all leading the cheer section for the war. It was no secret to anyone except those who live in denial and those who are reluctant to say things that are considered to be politically incorrect. I gave that testimony to a committee of Congress as well as to MSNBC, and within 3 hours of my testimony, prominent congresspeople from New York issued a collective statement calling me anti-Semitic because I said that Israel and the United States wanted to dominate that part of the world. You know, hello, why does Israel have 200 to 300 nuclear weapons if it doesn't want to dominate that part of the world? The problem is now, and I'll just finish with this, is that the strategic situation has changed markedly for Israel in the wake of what happened in Egypt. Up until now, and that is for the last 32 years, the Israelis could look at their southern and western border, the one with Egypt, and say, no problem there. Mubarak has been co-opted. He acquiesces in our determination to dominate that part of the world, okay, our hegemony over the Middle East. And so we can turn our attention to Gaza, West Bank, Syria, Lebanon. Hey, you name it. Now, we have carte blanche. We can do what we want. We don't have to worry about our southern frontier. Now they do. And if there's going to be some democracy, real democracy in Egypt, and the will of the people is going to determine policy or influence it, well, the Israelis have to contend with the fact that, according to the latest polls, 90% of the Egyptians really hate what the Israelis have been doing vis-a-vis Gaza, vis-a-vis the Palestinians in the Black and the West Bank, and Lebanon as well. And so there is ample cause for concern on the part of the Israeli government. My suggestion to them is to redesign their policy. Might doesn't always make right, and sometimes it doesn't work. They don't work out a compromise agreement with the Palestinians. They're in for trouble, not only over the longer term, but over the medium term and maybe within the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Well, first, let me ask you this. Are you anti-Semitic?
Why do you ask me that?
It's kind of a trick question.
Yeah. Okay. No, I'm not anti-Semitic, but I resent the question.
Okay.
This is a question that is loaded to indicate that I might be informing my analysis by some sort of bias. I'm not anti-Irish. I'm a little bit anti-British, but that's only because I listened to all the stories my grandmother told me about what the British did to her and her family. But I'm not anti-Semitic. I come from the Bronx, for God's sake. I grew up with Jews right and left, some of my best friends, and my dad has an honorary doctorate from Yeshiva University. Now, if I say that Israel is a major factor in our country's decision to initiate a war of aggression, that is fact supported by evidence, okay? There's abundant evidence that that's the case, and people should not shy away from that. And when I tell people that when they say, oh, well, Israel's our ally, you know, Dave, Israel is not our ally. Would you believe that? When I speak to audiences of, let's say, 300 or 400 at a university, and I ask, well, how many people believe that Israel is our ally? You know, usually, everybody raises their hand but maybe 2 or 3 people. To be an ally, you need to have a mutual defense treaty. There is no mutual defense treaty between the United States of America and Israel. And there's a story behind that. After 1973, when the Arabs did launch an attack on Israeli-occupied territory, we went to the Israelis in a very, very discreet diplomatic way and said, look, you know, we don't like this happening to you. We think a good solution would be a mutual defense treaty. And the Israelis said, you know, thanks very much, but no thanks. Now, why would they do that? But number one is that a mutual defense treaty requires internationally recognized borders. There was no way the Israelis wanted to raise the issue of the occupied territories within their current borders as opposed to the legal ones that they had before 1967.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, if you have a mutual defense treaty with another government, you know, it's sort of de rigueur. It's sort of expected that if you're going to hit out at a third country, it's going to attack it or invade it, as Israel has done with respect to Lebanon, for example, and you're supposed to say, well, by your leave, or you're supposed to sort of tip off the other country that this is what you're going to do so they know what to expect. The Israelis didn't want any part of that either. So there you have a very interesting situation. Now, I'm talking about the Israeli government now, not the Israeli people, of course. But the Likud government and the traditional governments that have been in power in Tel Aviv, they looked at the situation and said, you know, who needs a treaty? We kill 1,400 people in Gaza, and the U.S. Congress will applaud it. The UN commissions an investigation by Goldstone, a Jewish jurist from South Africa. He comes up and says that we assassinated 1,400 people in Gaza. The U.S. Congress will say, don't pay any attention to that. They're wrong. So who needs a treaty? You know, there's kind of a vicious joke here that goes like this. Somebody wanted Israel to consider becoming the 51st state for the United States of America. And the answer came back, no, we're not interested in that because then we'd only have two senators. Yeah, I wish it was funny, you know?
Well, it's funny because it's true. It's horribly true. I know. I've interviewed members of Congress. I interviewed Brian Baird. He actually went to Gaza several times and saw the destruction firsthand. And he read the Goldstone report. And he's pretty certain that nobody else did read the Goldstone report. Yet they, in lockstep, condemned the Goldstone report because the Israeli government said to do it. Do you think that AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, has too much influence on the United States of America, the Congress and the Senate?
Well, they should be registered as an agent of foreign power. That's pure and simple. I don't know how they escape that, but those are the rules. And even when their minions are caught spying on us, you know, literally purloining classified information and giving it to the Israeli embassy, they get off. They're not brought to trial, whereas Bradley Manning, the presumed leaker to WikiLeaks, is in solitary confinement for 10 months now down in Quantico, Virginia, the Marine brig.
Right. Sleeping naked, I read just this week. Does it shock you that so many United States political representatives are calling for the pardon of Israeli spy Jonathan Pollard? Isn't that amazing that he has such a rooting section that he spied on the United States, he gave all this information to Israel, did severe damage to our intelligence apparatus and resulted in a lot of people getting killed, and that information was even used by the Israeli government to hand over to the Soviets to get Jews out of the Soviet Union. Do you think that that's indicative of Jews in positions of power in this country having a dual loyalty, having too much control over what goes on here? Is it a very serious situation, or is it something that is being blown out of proportion by a couple of people?
Well, it's very serious indeed, Dave. When you look at the hatred that our policies in the Middle East have caused among 1.3 billion, I'll say it again, 1.3 billion Muslims in the world. And when you see that a lot of that behavior is conditioned by our being joined to Israeli policy, however violent, joined at the hip, then you can see what damage this is doing to the interests of the United States. That's why I say, particularly in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq, that the so-called neoconservatives, the neocons, the people in charge, Richard Perle, Wolfowitz, Feith, the whole coterie of folks that was running our policy at that time, that they had great difficulty distinguishing between what they considered to be the strategic interests of Israel on the one hand and the strategic interests of the United States of America on the other. They tend to see them as identical, and they're not identical. I have a little tidbit that I can share here now. Wolfowitz, okay? His father was an ardent Zionist. But when Wolfowitz was largely responsible for the invasion of Iraq, his father wrote him a note, and the note said, Paul, I am an ardent Zionist, but first and foremost, I'm an American. And what you have done for the Zionist cause is beyond the pale, and you should be ashamed of yourself. Father to son, ardent Zionist to ardent Zionist, the first one having his head screwed on right, having become a real American, and being able to see what our policy, in this case an attack on a foreign country, would bring in terms of grief to so many people, all because Son Paul put Israel before the interests of the United States.
Yeah, I didn't know about that letter, that communication.
Nobody did till now. Nobody else. Remember where you heard it first. Time to be very candid and blunt about this. I got this from an unimpeachable source, and this is the first time that enough distance has been created between Wolfowitz and our government that I feel free to tell that story. It's a real story, and it's a very telling story.
Yeah, obviously, and I appreciate you breaking it here on this interview. It's very nice of you. February 15th, is that right? You were at a speech in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, it was February 15th that I had my incident with Hillary Clinton.
And you were wearing a Veterans for Peace t-shirt.
Yeah, I'm a proud member. It's a wonderful organization. They do all manner of good things, not only here, but abroad. And on my way out of the house that day, I said, well, maybe I'll wear this shirt because I'd run out of other undershirts and had it on beneath my dress shirt. What happened, Dave, was very simple. I'm sitting there, and we all had to be in place for an hour and a half before the Secretary of State came out onto the stage. Well, maybe it was an hour, and well, it was about an hour, I guess. In any case, we're sitting there, and then all of a sudden, sort of like, you know, the Queen of Sheba coming in here.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody rises, and oh, man, the applause was... So I'm politely applauding, too, and I'm thinking, oh, wait a second. McGovern, this is pretty phony for you to be applauding a person responsible for all manner of death, destruction, what's going on in Afghanistan now, and what has gone on elsewhere in Gaza, and, you know, what am I doing? And so I decided, well, I couldn't really be true to myself if I just kept clapping and sat down like everybody else. So I remained standing. I took off my outer shirt to reveal the Veterans for Peace, turned my back. That was about, oh, maybe 12 yards away from a right front and center. And I turned my gaze to the back and fixed my gaze on a certain part of the back of the auditorium. And I was standing there motionless, speechless, not saying a word. All she could see on the back of my shirt was www.veteransforpeace.org. Pretty non-threatening, although it was in the shape of a crescent, you know. So maybe, you know, a crescent most, you know, could have raised suspicions, I suppose, by a bodyguard. Anyhow, all kidding aside, I'm standing there, and I'm standing there for about 2 minutes. And I'm saying, well, you know, this is going well. She must not emerge from this talk with the idea that everybody thinks that she's wonderful and that her policies are for peace. They're not for peace. They're for war. She's never went into a war that she hasn't fallen in love with. She makes Lady Macbeth look like a piker, okay? I'm standing there and thinking all these thoughts, but minding my own business, and I had my, you know, sort of single gaze, and I was literally blindsided. You know what blindsided means? These two guys, one came up behind me, and one plainclothes guy in front of me, the guy behind me, there was no warning. There was no warning at all. They grabbed me, hammerlock to the head, dragged me out into the aisle, and they were out of there in maybe 45 seconds or so. And you could see Hillary, she's speaking during all this. She doesn't miss a syllable, okay? She never acknowledges that something is going on. And then, you know, the supreme irony is that she's making a speech about freedom, about violence against protesters. She's talking about Egypt. Just a paragraph after I get dragged out, she says, Iran is again using violence against protesters. All they're doing is seeking basic freedoms. People protested, they stood, and the authorities arrested them.
Right.
Oh, gosh, I'm reading this, you know, after I get out of jail that day, and I'm saying, wow, this is like something right out of Franz Kafka.
Right.
And the disappointing thing is that the irony appeared not to be heeded or even recognized by the people sitting there, because they all sat there very obediently, like a bunch of sheeple. And I have to say that on my way out, even though I was violently assaulted, having not said a word, there wasn't one person, not one person in all that auditorium said, hey, what are you doing, that guy? What's going on here? Not one. And they artfully dragged me out into the street and locked the doors so none of the 18 TV stations that were videotaping Hillary could come out and see what they were doing to me. And what they did was two sets of these steel handcuffs. I started bleeding all over the back of my pants. One of the guards says, there's blood. The other says, yeah, I pricked my finger. Right, pricked his finger. There's a big hemisphere of blood on the back of my pants.
Jeez.
distracting from the other stuff they did. It's pretty brutal.
You know, it just goes to show how large the disconnect is between their political theater and reality when she could be giving a speech about a Middle Eastern country and how they do not put up with any protests. And right in front of her, as you could see on the video, like you said, here you are being accosted by some mercenaries, and she didn't even break her gaze. Amazing. They took you to jail, you said?
Yeah, that's what happened. They put me in a police car, George Washington University police car, and then I'm bleeding all over the back seat there. It didn't seem to bother them at all. And so I had to wait about an hour before the district cops came, and the District of Columbia cops were told that this guy was disorderly. He interrupted, he heckled the speech. Fox News must have got their headlines from these guys.
Right.
And I said, that's not true. And the D.C. policeman didn't seem at all interested. Come with me. So I ended up in a D.C. police thing. They took me up to the second precinct, second district headquarters, thrown into jail, real small, a smaller cell than Bradley Manning's in. I was booked. I was fingerprinted. I don't know what they do with fingerprints these days, but giving about 34 fingerprints seemed a little excessive. Booking, you know, the mugshot, the whole business. And then I was put in a cell for the next 3.5 hours. Finally, they gave me this piece of paper. I said, here, sign this. I said, what is it? They said, well, it's a disorderly conduct charge. You have to appear in court. So I said, well, I can't sign it because I can't see it. Give me my glasses. Just sign a thing.
Nice.
So I held it about 10 feet in front of me and could just make out enough to say it was a summons to court for disorderly conduct. I signed it about dusk, about 5:30. I got out of there, at which point I went to the emergency room, and they x-rayed my wrists and my forearm where I had a major hematoma, and they dressed my wounds and said two things. Now, Mr. McGovern, this was at the end, you know, the protocol required them to say this. This was the physician's assistant. Said, Mr. McGovern, you've been the object of an assault, and so you must realize that some of your wounds and bruises won't become apparent until the next few days, and also you may feel unsafe for a long period of time. These psychological problems are normal, so don't worry about them. Now, number two, Mr. McGovern, we as an emergency room are not required to report physical assaults, but you are, and you have to go to the police and report this. And the guy looks at me and says, like that, because he knew the whole story, you know. He says, I know you're not going to go to the police, but I had to tell you that. So there was the prospect of having to go back to the police and say, well, the police brutalized me, which, of course, I didn't do. But the good news was that a friend of mine put me onto a partnership, a nonprofit legal firm that defends people like me on charges of disorderly conduct. That charge has already been dropped. So I was the beneficiary of a very, very caring and very expert little law firm, and I'm very grateful for that.
You were just standing there silent with your back turned from Clinton.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there was no heckling at all. If you're interested in a little funny thing, the next morning I get a call from the Iranian news service. And they heard about this incident with Hillary Clinton. And I often give interviews to the Iranians or the Russians or the Greeks or the Al Jazeerans or the BBC. Nobody asked me to go on CNN. Anyhow, and they said, now, would you come down and talk to us from the studio? We'd like to do a live broadcast tonight, or this afternoon, our time. So I went down there, and the interviewer, a lady, she said, now, Mr. McGovern, we understand that a heckler interrupted Hillary Clinton, and they didn't know exactly what he was about to do, but they thought he might have a sign that he was going to wave or that he might shout out, and so he was escorted out of the auditorium. What do you think about that? It was only then clear to me, Dave, that they didn't know it was me, okay? And so I said, well, first lesson, you can't really believe what you hear or what you read in Fox News headlines. And so she gets a little, you know, she says, well, how do you know? It was I. And let me tell you what really happened. Oh, was you? And then the interview got kind of fun. But what's my point? The point of telling you this is that if the only, quote, mainstream media outlet, end quote, that reports on this is Fox News, and that indeed was and remains the case today, foreign outlets or foreign news services or anybody else who's interested, when they Google, the only mainstream source they see is Fox News. And so they take those titles and make me out to be a heckler. Now, would I have heckled? Oh, I don't think I would heckle. You don't get anything by heckling. Standing in silent witness, I think that's a much more effective and incredibly nonviolent way to show that you don't agree with the terrible stuff that's going on in Afghanistan, especially in the Middle East, and in which Hillary Clinton has the unique ability to avoid, to deny the effects of her policies. You know, this goes back to when her husband was president. You have 500,000 children in Iraq dead because of the sanctions regime. Did she care about it? Well, I don't know. She was only first lady. Did Madeleine Albright care about it? Not really. When she was asked if she would do it over, she said, no, no. It was worth it, is the way she said it. So These people, well, they really are the upper crust. They don't have any idea of the brutality that their policies result in. Not only brutality against Iraqis or Afghans, but brutality against our own soldiers. And that comes through in the WikiLeaks reporting and the WikiLeaks video, collateral murder. It's brutalizing everybody, and she's standing up there, not missing a syllable, not missing a dignified speech, and that should not be allowed to occur. So I'm not hurting as much as I was the last couple of weeks. I'm glad I did it, because she should not be able to say, well, all those people at GW University just loved what I was saying, and they have no problems with the policies that I advocate and implement.
It is disturbing. It's disturbing for all of humanity, not just for, of course, those poor children, 500,000 kids who were starved or killed or brutalized, whatever happened to them. It's very difficult to fathom being a dad with three boys. I can't even hurt an insect, so I don't understand how these people, could sleep.
I can have an insight into that from one of my granddaughters, okay? Little Claire. She's out in Oakland, and she's watching me on TV with her mother, my daughter Kathleen. And when it's all over, she rushes up to Kathleen, and she says, well, Mommy, that was Grandpa. And Kathleen says, yeah. She said, well, Mommy, that means the other people are real, too. Now, that's really cute right on the surface of it.
Right.
But think about what that means. Think carefully about what that means. That means if you don't know someone in the picture, the other people are not real, too. God knows we don't even have pictures of Afghanistan, of Iraq. We have embedded photographers, embedded journalists who are not allowed to send pictures back, not of the kind that we had in Vietnam almost every day. And so if you live in this hermetically sealed world of privilege with the rest of the upper crust, it's very easy to just live in denial and just pretend that you don't know what's going on in places like that. If you don't have someone you know in the picture, which nobody does in upper-class Washington, you know where the soldiers are coming from. They're coming from small towns in this country of less than 50,000 people. They're coming from the inner city. This is a poverty draft. We should be ashamed of ourselves.
You're absolutely right, Ray. Now, I want to direct the listeners to the website truthout.org, which is truth-out.org, and you can do a search for Ray McGovern. And there's an article there written by David Swanson, Police Brutalize Ray McGovern as Hillary Clinton Talks Free Speech. And there's actually photos there of you with the damage that was done. And above that, it says, tell Hillary Clinton what you think of this behavior, and it has a phone number, 202-647-4000. Is that something that would make sense for the listeners to ring that number? Do you really think it would make any difference? Do they even listen to what we think? And by we, I mean your average American.
You know, Dave, that was my question, too. But when we arrived at my arraignment, or what was supposed to be my arraignment, the very sensitive lawyer who was with me was a little bit surprised that I was put in the category of people driving with a suspended driver's license. And I was told not to come back. I was given a piece of paper which said that the district attorney or the attorney general of the District of Columbia had decided that there wasn't enough evidence to proceed with my case. The lawyer said, this is really amazing. And one of the interpretations was that although the mainstream media carried only that misleading Fox headline, the internet was, I'm told, really, really very active in my defense. And all manner of telephone calls went into the State Department, to George Washington University, to the district police, to just about everybody. And in this case, the lawyers thought that probably had a considerable impact and that the government just didn't want to pursue it anymore because there was nothing but further embarrassment for them, given the fact the videotape shows how brutally I was treated for not doing anything but standing.
So in this case, it does make sense. Let me give that number out, because even though this happened 3 weeks ago, it still would make sense for folks to let Hillary Clinton know what they think about the behavior that occurred that day. And the phone number is 202-647-4000. Also, I want to give listeners the website for Veterans for Peace. And of course, as you said earlier, it's veteransforpeace.org. I gave the website where Hillary Clinton interrupted by protester. They should have said silent protester. Why do you think the corporate media, the mainstream media, hasn't paid any appropriate attention to this story? Why do you think it is that everyone in the audience that day didn't make a peep, didn't raise a hand? They watched you being brutalized by two mercenaries. They said nothing. Why do you think that is?
Well, the charitable explanation for the latter is that it all happened without warning, very abruptly. Had I been screaming, or had I been heckling, or had I been causing some sort of disturbance, there would have been people attuned to the fact that something was about to happen to me. But as things turned out, I was making no noise, no gestures, no nothing. No sign, by the way. And these guys came down, lifted me out, so there was hardly any time to react. So that's the charitable explanation. The other explanation is that people are afraid, and that's the whole deal. And so what happens to the video that shows me being large manhandled most viciously? Well, the video of that goes up on the George Washington University website. Now, why do you suppose that's the case? Do you think they're embarrassed? No. The whole idea of this is to make McGovern an object lesson. You see, some of the kids, some of the young students there at GW, have been actually challenging some administration orators or speakers that come. Some of them have been standing up and arguing with them, you know, like university students are supposed to do.
Sure.
Well, the lesson for them was, look, you so much as get up and stand when you're supposed to be sitting, or turn your back on somebody without saying a word, this is what's going to happen to you. So be aware of that. Just take that into your calculations before you, quote, disrupt, end quote, any such gathering. So that, I think, is why the video was so prominently used by GW University itself. As for the lack of media coverage, well, this is highly embarrassing when you look at the Secretary of State talking about dissent should be protected and the internet should be a place where dissenters could, and she's talking about, one sentence comes five paragraphs after I was carried out, she says, quote, Iran is awful because it is a government that routinely violates the rights of its people, period, end quote. Well, hello. All any decent commentator would have to do, were this to have been in the news, would say, well, wait a second. You know, was not this gentleman's rights violated by being subjected to the treatment? So what they wanted to do was close it down and not let it get out. And despite the fact that there were some 18, as I counted, video cameras back there, the word went out, don't cover it. It was early enough. You know, it was like, 12:30 is when she started her speech. So the news cycle, they could easily put it on the evening news, but the word went out, no, don't touch it. And nobody came to ask me who I was. The only person who came to ask me who I was a Secret Service person, Hillary being entitled to Secret Service protection as well as diplomatic security protection from the State Department, as well as GW protection, as well as DC protection. She was very well protected, and nobody came and asked me who I was, why I was doing it. And that just, I think, points up the sorry state of the Fourth Estate. I've been saying for some time now that the Fourth Estate, present company accepted, of course, the Fourth Estate is defunct. And that's why, with that bad news, we desperately need some good news. And luckily, there is good news, and that is there's a Fifth Estate. It exists in the ether. It is not susceptible of government, advertiser, corporation, security unit control. So far, it's free. And WikiLeaks, of course, is the best example of that. And we know one heck of a lot more about Afghanistan, about Pakistan, about Iraq, about the Middle East and other places than we ever would have had not Bradley Manning done the manly thing and said, look, I'm going to take this risk because it's important if we're to be a democracy that the American people be exposed to what's really going on. And to see him pay the kind of price that he's being subjected to now, equivalent to torture, you know, that shows how bad it's gotten here. We got to put a stop to that. As Michael Moore says, we got to get off our couches. He could have said off something else. We have to get up and make sure that we protect the freedoms that people before us fought and died for.
Ray McGovern, I want to thank you so much for taking the time out to explain this to all our listeners. And you're doing a great thing. You are a patriot. And I want to thank you for everything that you're doing for this country.
You're most welcome.